Hello and welcome back to ADHD Mums. In this podcast, we tackle the tough, often unspoken realities of motherhood, neurodiversity and mental health.
This mini-series is on domestic violence and it contains distressing content. There is physical and sexual violence listed with a lived experience in the middle of this episode. Please be aware, click back out of it if you do not want to continue on. This is the first on a mini series about ending violence against women. I want to say really openly, I don't have personal experience with domestic violence, and a part of me feels like I don't have a right to even do this mini series because I don't have lived experience. The reason that I'm doing it anyway is because where domestic violence lives, I believe, is in the dark where nobody knows, and that suits the perpetrator. They don't want the survivor to speak to people. They want them cut off. They want them silenced. And what I'm wanting to do is to create a platform to give these women a voice. I used to refer to victim of domestic violence, but from what has been explained to me, that a lot of women prefer the word survivor. They feel that that's more empowering to say the word survivor. I'm going to keep going with survivor. The reason I'm doing this mini series is because I want the Australian government to put more resources in, shed more light on this issue, and to create a better family court system, particularly where the perpetrator can no longer abuse the survivor through the child, through the court system, and gain access to a child and then abuse their ex-partner through it. It's really difficult to touch on every single issue, and this is an incredibly complex issue, and I'm going to do my best to do it justice. And the reason that I'm using gender-specific terms is because 75% of all survivors of domestic violence have reported that their perpetrator was male. So we are talking about a majority of men here, and only 25% reported that the perpetrator was female. So I'm not making the assumption that this is men. This is men because that's what the research shows. And I'm happy to put the references into the show notes. So I am using men and I am using women because it's true and it's fact. Obviously, in this day and age, relationships look really different. And I don't want to dismiss any of those people at all. However, I'm going to talk about male and female purely because that's the majority. And it's just easier than every single time I reference male and female to reference every different type of relationship that there is. I think it would become really taxing to listen to. So I'm going to just be using the gender assigned at birth, male or female, just purely for ease. And also because the only people that I've interviewed in this mini series are female to male relationships. That's not necessarily by choice. That's just because they were the people that responded. Neurodivergent people generally are quite honest and they're quite straight with their intentions. They have a good intention, so it doesn't occur to them that others around them don't. And I've done that many times where I just assume that I'm going in this with the right reasons. I'm doing the best thing by this person. I assume they're doing that back. That's not necessarily the case. So this is a really big issue for neurodivergent women because we are more likely to grow up with trauma, which means that we can be more likely to have difficult relationships. And then we could be more likely to not see those red flags when we are looking for a romantic partner. There was a study that came out in Europe a couple of years ago, and it stated that 9 out of 10 autistic women had been sexually assaulted in their lifetime. So when we're talking about women being neurodivergent and some of the risk factors, we know that they are going to be more at risk in terms of domestic violence, which is why I'm sharing it on this platform. This year, 13th of April, 2024, a 40-year-old man stabbed and killed 6 people and injured 12 in the Westfield Bondi Junction shopping centre. 5 women and 1 man died, and the injured included a 9-month girl. One of the women that died that got a lot of press release, that was the mother of the baby that was stabbed, was Ash Good, who lived on the Sunshine Coast. I was friends with her for at least 5 or 6 years. I was treated by her as an osteopath initially, and we made friends. And I remember when she moved to Sydney, she was so excited, and she'd been posting on Facebook about becoming a new mother. And I was just so happy for her. So to actually know her, having had lunch with her, shopped with her, the local shopping centers here, having had a relationship with her, it just seemed so real. And right before the Bondi Junction killing, Samantha Murphy was murdered in Ballarat. One of the things that really struck, I think, everybody about Samantha Murphy was that she just went out for a run. She wasn't doing anything to anybody. And I mean, God, I absolutely hate it when people talk about what you were wearing or what you were drinking. It doesn't matter what you were wearing or what you were drinking. You don't deserve to be attacked. It's so disgusting to hear about people that talk about as if the woman deserved it in some way. But the innocent act of going for a run and being a mum and just going out for your run, that was probably her self-care time, and being killed was just, I think it hit Australia hard. The amount of women that are being killed is staggering. But I don't want to just shine light on this issue. We already know it's there. We want a point. I want this mini-series to mean something. And to prevent violence, we need to understand it. We need to see it. We need to know what it is, and we need to know how to stop it. There was one woman that I spoke to that will come up in this mini-series, and she was with someone for over 15 years, and she did not know in the first 10 years that she was being abused. It took her 10 years to know. There's other women that I'm very good friends with that was with their partner for such a long period, and they did not know that they were being abused. One of the reasons that we're doing this mini series is because I want to create a reference point for people who are listening, or women who are listening, that may have some inklings that maybe something isn't right, but not know. A lot of women I've spoken only realized that there was something going on when they heard from other women. They watched YouTube, they read things, and they started to go, oh, that's similar to me. Oh, is that not the way things are? So remember as well, if we're neurodivergent and we've been told our lives that we are the problem, or perhaps our feelings aren't valid. So for example, you know, if you found it really difficult to wear your school uniform because of the scratchy jumper and the school shoes, but you're repeatedly told there is no issue, everyone else is wearing it, I don't know what your problem is. We start to lose self-awareness and body awareness, and we learn not to trust ourselves. When we learn not to trust ourselves, we miss the red flags. And so if we somehow end up in one of those relationships, I would love, my best case scenario creating this mini series is that I would have some women who send me emails or DMs and say, I saw myself. I heard my own voice. I got it. Wow, I did not know. I've nudged gently some of the women who have shared to give specific examples, because otherwise a lot of neurodivergent women think, well, that it's not that bad. They have imposter syndrome. I can't claim DV. I mean, I wasn't hit. And it's that minimizing of the behavior and normalizing it, which makes it very easy for perpetrators to continue. Firstly, let's go back a step and break down what is violence against women. It's not just physical violence against women. It's any act of gender-based violence that causes or is likely to cause physical, sexual, or psychological harm or suffering to women. This could be threats or coercion as well. Whether it's happening in someone's home or whether it's happening in the workplace, online, it's all part of the same thing. In Australia, we use many different terms to describe the different forms of violence: domestic violence, intimate partner violence, coercive control, workplace, sexual harassment, street harassment, and sexual assault. Whilst these terms are used, they all are around the broad umbrella of violence against women. The key takeaway here is it doesn't matter what we call it. At the end of the day, it's about power and control. And it's overwhelming the amount of men that will perpetuate this violence. Let's talk numbers and statistics, and this can really help us understand the scale of the problem. Today, there are 2 in 5 women in Australia, which is around 39%, have experienced violence before the age of 15. That's nearly half of the female population. 1 in 32 children in Australia have received child protective services. 67% of those children were repeat clients, and over 30,000 children have been in and out of home care environment for over 2 years. Children from remote areas are 3 times more likely to be in child protective services or under the watchful gaze of them than in major cities. So if we think, and one of the things that really struck me about the interviews that is going to come forward on this mini-series is that in a lot of the cases, the perpetrators still have access to their children. And whether they should or not is not up to me to decide. It's not just a few isolated cases, it's a crisis that's affecting millions of women in this country. And the majority of the violence comes from people that victims know. Women are more likely to be harmed by a current or a former partner than by a stranger. And I think that's what made it even more terrifying with the Bondi Junction stabbing and also with Samantha Murphy, who was running, in that it made it feel random, like we couldn't control it and we could be killed at any moment. But the reality is that the fact that that happened is just a reflection to me of how large scale the issue is. Because if that's happening just openly, then what's happening behind closed doors? So it almost makes us feel safe, like it's not an issue that affects us, because I am not in a domestic violence relationship, so it's nothing to do with me. But it's that attitude that is the problem. And I find it staggering the amount of men that I speak to that take no ownership, no responsibility for the state of this country and the way that men treat women. It's like if they don't do it themselves, it doesn't affect them. They're not responsible. They have no opinion. They're like hands off. And that is part of the message and the problem that I have, because men have a responsibility to acknowledge all the microaggressions towards women. And I have a responsibility as someone who hasn't experienced domestic violence to care. Imagine if I said, oh, well, it's not happening to me, so I don't have an opinion, I'm not concerned about it. What about my daughter? What about my friends? What about the people around me? What about society? What about people and just my general care? So for men who aren't perpetrating, I still believe they have a responsibility, as do I when I'm doing this podcast. So by saying that you're not affected, so it's not your responsibility, so you don't need to do anything about it, I think is a cop-out. I'm not affected personally, so why would I bother? Well, I bother because I care and I'm a good person. So 35% of women have experienced violence from someone close to them, while only 11% have been harmed by a stranger. On average, we know that one woman is killed every 9 days by her current or former partner in Australia. And that's just not a number. That's a life lost. That's a person every single week. It's horrifying. And it's something we can't afford to keep ignoring. I spoke to a couple of people about this week, and one of them in particular said to me that they didn't want to talk about it after only 5 minutes because it was too confronting. She didn't feel it was relevant. So I know this person really well, and I know that they don't have any triggers. It's just that they just don't want to know.
We can't afford to ignore what's heavy or uncomfortable. Just because a topic feels difficult to talk about doesn't mean we can turn away from it. But avoiding these conversations don't make the problems go away. It just silences the people who are suffering. I believe it's our responsibility as a society to acknowledge the weight of the issues, to create the space where they need to be discussed, and to offer support where we can. Yes, the content's heavy, but the lives impacted are real.
In 2021 and 2022, over 4,600 women were hospitalised due to family and domestic violence. That's an average of 13 a day. And the violence isn't just about bruises, broken bones. It's emotional abuse, financial control, and the constant threat of harm. One in four women have experienced some sort of abuse by a partner, and one in three have experienced physical violence. These are not rare occurrences. This is happening at home, workplaces, in the community, and it's probably happening to people around you. We also should talk about the specific vulnerabilities of certain groups. Women with disabilities are twice as likely to experience sexual violence, and women with psychological or cognitive impairments face even higher risk. The reality for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women are 31 times more likely to be hospitalised due to family violence-related assaults than other women. It's a massive systemic failure that is putting these women at an unacceptable level of risk. The impact of this violence is profound. The violence against women leaves very long-lasting emotional, psychological, financial scars. For women between 25 to 44, intimate partner violence is the leading cause of death, disability, and illness in Australia. So let's just recap. The more women in this age group are affected by intimate partner violence than any other risk factor. So here's a question. Why don't they just leave? And it's a question that needs to be asked, because we can imagine in a family court system, or we could imagine that that would be what the man would say. Well, why didn't you leave if it was so bad? The fact is that violence actually drives homelessness, and many women fleeing violent relationships have got actually nowhere to go. And I've spoken to women who will be in this mini series who did not have anything but the clothes on their back. Staying risks their lives. It's estimated that violence against women costs Australia $21.7 billion every year. But that's not just a financial burden, that's a reflection on the long-term damage caused by individuals, families, and entire communities. So if we strip it back, and this is really complex, and I feel very uncomfortable, like an imposter making comment, but after speaking to a lot of women and doing this intro at the end, what I would say is that what I think is that at the heart of it is just pure gender inequality. Violence against women in any form is basically an unequal power dynamic. It shows up in so many different ways. And if we just look at a couple of the different ways, it would be like the gender pay gap, where women are still doing less, are still getting paid less for doing the same work, or that women are underrepresented in leadership roles. It's not a coincidence. It's a reflection of the deep-rooted power imbalances. And I don't need to tell you ladies about the burden of unpaid labor, caregiving, managing a house, having the mental load, being the primary caregiver falls disproportionately on women. It's huge, and the invisible workload limits women's opportunities to advance and contribute, or it just leads to pure burnout. Meanwhile, men seem to be largely unaffected of these inequalities because they aren't expected to shoulder the same responsibilities at home. And because they aren't directly impacted, many men just stay silent. They don't speak up when they see the injustice because a lot of them don't see it as a problem. They actually don't think it affects them. And what is even more troubling is that how these attitudes are reinforced. I looked at a really popular podcast recently, and it made a really bad joke about the way a mother looked and how it didn't matter because she was managing the kids at home. And it was shared as a reel across Instagram. And I immediately went to the comments to see if anyone had said something, and there were hidden comments. So I assume there were people that were upset by that. All of the really small things matter. I see how it all contributes and paints a picture. I don't think it's black and white. Like, there are some men that are DV perpetrators and there are good men. I don't think there are two categories. And by a lot of the men just saying that they're in the good category, and I'm air quoting, means that they don't have any relationship. They don't know these men. They're not the people that they know. They have no influence or power over them, I don't think is true. I think there's crossover and there's ways that men participate in building this culture that they're probably unaware of and that don't think matter. But I think this kind of mentality creates more toxic behaviors, and men are then surrounded by more cues that tell them it's okay to be silent or it's okay to laugh along, because they're not the ones doing it. And that's a cop-out. It's so deeply ingrained and passed down generations and normalized by the media and then echoed in everyday interactions. And it's like, if you call it out, you can't take a joke, which is so unfair. And so unfair against some of the men that maybe do try to talk, that do try to speak up, that are then ostracized or told they're too woke or they're the problem. I wonder though, if we strip this back, is it more about, this isn't just about like bad behavior of some men, it's also about a lack of skills. And Dr. Billy Garvey says it really well on the Imperfects podcast, Boys to Men. We're not teaching our children, especially boys, how to recognize these power dynamics, how to see inequality for what it is, or how to change it. we're not equipping them with the tools that they need to disrupt this cycle. One of the real turning points, and I had so much respect for the Imperfects podcast when they did this, was Penny Moodle, who is Hugh Van Kylenberg's wife, and I don't know how to pronounce that, sorry, Hugh. She said to him, "What responsibility do you bear?" And I'm paraphrasing, right? He says in the episode that he didn't really think the Bondi Junction stabbing had much to do with him or Samantha Murphy because, you know, he was a good person and he doesn't do that to women. I thought the way that the Imperfects did that podcast, the way that we need to get men to acknowledge, and I really want to credit them for that. I'm going to put that in the show notes as well, in that Let's Talk About Men was such an incredible episode. And it was really interesting because when I listened to that podcast, the night before I had gone to Kiwanis Shopping Centre, which is the shopping centre on the Sunshine Coast that I lived close to at the time. And I had gone there at dark and I had my four-year-old with me. And I had this moment of just like, I have been to this shopping centre with Ash Good. I have my child with me. What if I get killed? And I ended up driving down to a different IGA, which was a bit more well-lit. It was smaller. And I was like, if there's someone's going to go on a stabbing spree, it's probably not going to be at the local IGA that's really small and well-lit. And I took my son in there. And when I got home, I said to my husband, I felt really unsafe. And I started stressing about it. And he's like, well, what do you mean? As if something's going to happen, as if something's going to happen here. And I was like, well, someone who lived here went to Sydney and something happened there. If I said to you, I'm going to go to Bondi Westfield, I hope nothing happens to me today, you would say it was ridiculous. It feels like this issue is systemic and it's deeply rooted into our culture. But I don't want to get caught that we can't change it. Like, I don't want to make this issue so big that people are like, oh, I don't know what to do about it. It's difficult, but it's not impossible. And it starts with awareness and it starts with being aware of what's going on, which is the purpose of this mini series, but also then challenging the status quo, calling out the jokes, questioning why women are carrying the load and speaking up to see the inequality in our workplaces and home and breaking the silence and shifting the conversation. Because if we don't, we're just reinforcing the very systems that keep women in a position of less power. So considering I don't have lived experience, we're going to move in to a recording of someone with lived experience. Now, this person is anonymous and this isn't the real voice. Reason being is because pretty much every woman I think that's on this mini series is in the family court system with their perpetrator. And if their perpetrator was to find out that they've spoken out in some way, then they would then be possibly punished. And we'll go into that after. But the point that I'm making is that this is a voice actor. This is a real story. This is an Australian woman, and this is her story.
My name is Emily, and the first person to hurt me was my father. He was caught in a cycle of violence that had been passed down through generations, both a victim of his own upbringing and a perpetrator of that same abuse. Growing up in such a chaotic environment left deep scars on me. I learned early on that mistreatment was just part of life, whether it was emotional manipulation or physical harm. He constantly told me how worthless I was. I was more of a housekeeper than a daughter, cooking every night because my mum wasn't around much. He never asked about my life or cared what grade I was in. His only interest was having me clean up after him, clear his ashtrays and fetch his beers while he sat in front of the TV. For years, I played the role of both a cook and cleaner in my own home, craving approval that never came and slowly internalizing the belief that I was nothing more than a servant. The second abuser in my life was my husband. At first, I thought he was my savior. He swept into my life when I was just 16, a vulnerable teenager, desperate to escape my father's abuse. He was 25, older, and seemed to offer me everything I longed for: love, protection, and a way out of the life I knew. I left my father's house behind and moved in with him, but I never finished school. For that first year, it felt like I'd found my Prince Charming. He said all the right things, told me how horrible my father was, and encouraged me to stay away from him. I believed him completely. I thought I had finally been saved. But slowly, his true colours began to show. He started tearing me down bit by bit. He cut me off from the people I cared about, isolated me from friends and family, and even took control of our finances, draining everything we had. He took over my life just like my father had, but this time I had nowhere left to run. The abuse started subtly but escalated over time. He controlled every aspect of my life, how I looked, who I spoke to, where I went. He dictated my thoughts until I started to believe that I was fat, stupid, and unworthy. When I became pregnant, things got worse. He beat me, even when I carried our child. I tried to leave several times, but I had no possessions, no shelter, no money. With nothing but a pram full of clothes and toys, my daughter and I wandered the streets, homeless and hopeless. One night, I went back to our apartment to collect more belongings, and he attacked me again. I barely escaped with my daughter, running to the nearest police station for help. But instead of finding protection, I was arrested. My abuser had convinced the police that he was the one being abused. It was my worst nightmare come true. My daughter was left in his custody and I was powerless to protect her. It felt like he was so much smarter than me every step of the way. He took her from me for 10 days. He said he would drop the charges if I returned home. I went back again and a while later I found him choking my daughter for not eating her dinner. He said he would never touch a child, but he did. He began hitting me and raped me a few times a week. I would beg him to wait until our child had gone to bed, and I'd give our daughter sleeping medicine to keep her asleep. Why didn't I leave? With no parents, no family, no money? I met him early in my life. I had no skills and no self-esteem. I left once and I was literally homeless. He always told me he would leave me homeless, and he did. Everything was in his name, and he didn't let me have a car. I only had $100 he gave me in cash once a week to buy groceries. It happened so slowly. I didn't realise what was happening until he had cut me off from everyone. After 7 long years together, I ended the relationship, but he refused to accept it. What followed was a campaign of harassment. He stalked me relentlessly, waiting outside my friend's house, breaking into her home, and even manipulating people around me to gain access to my life. He claimed I took his daughter away for no reason. He watched every move I made, sending me messages about my daily schedule, my work shifts, and even my bank transactions, all to keep me under his control. His vengeance went further. I got a job at a bakery, which I was really proud of. He kept harassing me at work, staring at me, emailing my boss stories about what an awful person I was, and he ruined my reputation at work until I was forced to quit a job that I loved. My boss felt sorry for me, but didn't want to get involved. It was hard because I didn't have a lot of life experience or confidence, but eventually I went to the police and was able to get a protection order. He violated this order over 100 times and demands access to his daughter. He is now on a community corrections order and facing some consequences, but despite his history, the family court still allows my ex-husband unsupervised access to our daughter. I've pleaded with everyone, doctors, child protection agencies, police and lawyers, but the system only intervenes when it's extreme. Apparently, this isn't extreme enough. We have to wait for something to happen. I feel like my ex will terrorize me through my child, letting me know he took her out deep in the ocean and with her amongst big waves and smiles as he says, "Lucky I held on to her," letting me know that he can take her life at any point. Domestic violence continues because some men choose to abuse. They believe they have the right to control and harm their partners, and society often turns a blind eye. But we deserve better.
Was moving, wasn't it? I know this is a heavy subject, but I want to give this the airtime that it deserves because by not listening, turning off, or not airing the heavy shit gives the perpetrators power, which grinds me to no end. I know I've painted a heavy problem, but I want to move into how we can prevent it. I don't want to just paint a picture and then not do anything about it. How do we prevent it? What can we do? Over the past decade, we have seen a decline in violence, and the attitudes towards gender equality have actually improved. There's been some progress, but there's a lot of work that still needs to be done. Australia has implemented significant reforms, including the National Plan to End Violence Against Women and Children and the Respect at Work initiative. These are positive steps, but lasting change obviously requires a collective effort. We need governments, communities, families, and individuals to come together and address the root cause. And ending violence against women is not the responsibility of one person or an organisation. It's a shared responsibility for everybody in this country. There will be people listening to this episode that are currently in a domestic violence situation and would like to know how to leave. Or you're listening to this and you have a friend, or you just want to have an understanding of how you can help. I've never left a domestic violent relationship, so I do not know how hard it is. I can imagine how hard it would be, but I do not know. And I want to acknowledge that. We need to understand that everyone's circumstances is different. Escaping a family or a domestic violence situation would be one of the most terrifying things that I can imagine someone would do. One of the most important things, and I've talked to people on this mini series who have had one moment happen and they have got their child walked out or ran out, escaped all of a sudden. The majority of people that I spoke to said there wasn't one moment where they went, that's enough, and they just left. A lot of them talked about how it happened over a long period of time. Understanding, acknowledging, and then after a while, they eventually get to a place where they're like, I think I need to leave. And then they have to plan that for a long period, build up that confidence. And it can be quite a long road from the decision is a slow decision. And then they have quite a long planning process. So if you do have a chance to prepare, then you need to have the safest possible escape for you and your children. You need to consider contacting a support service, GP, treating mental health practitioner, local women's health centre, 1-800-RESPECT, to prepare a detailed safety plan, which you can implement to best ensure that both you and your children are safe when at home and escaping the home and leaving. Now, support services from the women that I've spoken to have all said that the specific people, the women, generally women, who work in these services are excellent. There may be some issues with the family court and some of the decisions and the legislation and how it works. That's different. The actual support services and the people inside them, I've only heard raving reviews. 1-800-RESPECT suggests packing an escape bag with essential items, including money, bank cards, phone, charger, spare keys, medication, prescriptions, personal ID, birth certificate, passport, grab insurance documents, child support, Centrelink, rental agreements, mortgage documents, Medicare, health records, legal documents. Have a bag packed that will ensure that you are best placed to leave if you have to leave quickly. Obviously, having that bag hidden would be the number one thing that I would be doing there. And again, this is not the plan. You need to call a service to get the plan. Domestic and family violence can have long-term negative impacts. We're talking major stress, possible PTSD, and a lot of women talked about just a complete undoing of any self-esteem that they've ever had. You can get a GP to access a counsellor, psychologist, psychiatrist. There's helplines. I'm going to put all of them in the show notes. Also, really have a look at technology and safety before you leave. The perpetrators often use technology to monitor, stalk, control, and abuse. So you'd want to have a look at, like, can you find any air tags? Can you find anything in your car? Do you have Find My Phone on? Are you attached to the cloud somehow? Can he get access to your messages through iPad, computer? Will he still have access to your messages after you leave? Have a look at that. That's really important. Changing settings and passwords may trigger a notification to the perpetrator if they are monitoring those accounts. So just be really careful where if you go, oh my God, I need to change my passwords, but it's getting notifications or recoveries somehow to the perpetrator, just be really aware that that could happen. When you're making your safety plan, they will go through this with you. There's also organizations that sweep your home and vehicles for recording devices and filming devices. There's also grants that you can receive around security cameras into your new home if you do choose to leave. The housing crisis really exacerbates some of the challenges that are faced by the survivors. If the police don't issue an apprehended domestic violence order, excluding the perpetrator from the home, the victim and the children may be left in a situation where they need to flee because the perpetrator is not then removed from the home. So if you don't have an apprehended domestic violence order, you may need to go up to a short-term plan of having to stay with a friend or family member in the interim. There's also emergency accommodations through women's refuges and shelters, and there's lots of different options online. And I'll put some of the websites into the show notes that have a safe exit where you can press the exit really quickly and everything removes and the browser history goes. You also want to have a look at legal aid. So if you approach legal aid first, you will be able to receive legal aid and the other person will be forced to pay. That's what happens in Queensland anyway. But have a look at family lawyers, and there's a lot of legal aid available for survivors of DV that need somebody to represent them in court. There's also financial assistance that's available, and I'll put in more in the show notes there. There's a crisis payment from Centrelink. Your family lawyer will help you file any applications with the family court for urgent review. There's also, you know, spousal maintenance, release of funds. If you need financial counselling, that's available as well. At the end of the day, though, if you do feel at risk, you need to contact the police. And they have the power to issue apprehended domestic violence orders. It will impose specific conditions on a person, banning them from certain behaviours such as stalking you, coming near you, contacting you, attending your home, damaging property. There's all kinds of things, and it's different state to state, so it can be confusing. But when you contact the services, they will let you know. There's a Women's Legal Service Australia and Legal Aid. 1800 RESPECT is a brilliant, brilliant hotline. It's free, confidential, and it can connect you with lots of different services. I'm sure I haven't been able to do this episode justice in terms of what needs to be discussed, but what I wanted to do was to open up with how prevalent the problem is, hear from somebody with lived experience that's in this country right now, and look at how we can prevent it, what we can do. Please don't think that there's nothing you can do. Have a conversation with your brother, any male relatives, any male friends that you know, have conversations with them about this. And again, I would recommend Imperfect Chat About Men, I think it's called. I'll have that in the show notes. Thank you for listening and thank you for sticking with me, because remember, this issue lives in the dark. By switching off, by pressing pause, by going, this isn't about me, I can't listen to this, this is too heavy, that's not helping the problem. We need to get aware and contribute to preventing and ending violence against women in this country. If this episode has triggered you in any way and brought up feelings, please reach out to somebody and also contact the hotlines listed. If you haven't had experience in DV and you're feeling affected by this episode, I think, I don't want to use the word normal, but I think that is normal in some ways. I felt incredibly affected this week by what I've heard, and incredibly scared for the generation coming through and for my daughter. I think some of these feelings are normal. It's not normal to not be affected by hearing this kind of heavy content. If you have any of those feelings, please reach out to somebody and also contact the hotlines listed. Thank you so much for listening. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. Together we can make a difference.
The key message here is you are not alone. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, follow us on Instagram or head over and join our amazing ADHD Mums podcast Facebook community. Everything you do matters and helps to spread the word about what neurodiversity in females looks like.